Hello once again, and let's begin our last conference concerning the humanitarian law, international humanitarian law in European Court judgments. You asked me yesterday why the European Court is so reluctant in Chechen cases. And I must say that it should be noted that until lately, the European Court of Human Rights tried to avoid applying directly the international humanitarian law in the cases connected with armed conflicts. Manifesting robust conservatism, it has never preferred the international humanitarian law as lex specialis to its own convention, who placed this lex specialis above the standards of the convention. And their strict application were more important for it. This restraint of the European Court could be also explained by the fact, you know, that first of all, by the fact that the convention adopted in 1950, in its Article 2, right to the life, envisaged some exceptions to this right. And you know that the international humanitarian law is directly linked with the right to a life. That's because it was a compromise at that time, the adoption of Article 2. It was mainly discussed, if you follow the tableau préparatoire of the convention, that it was a kind of compromise, some exceptions of Article 2. And that's because the court also adopted a rather prudent attitude. Moreover, if you look at the Article 15, paragraph 2 of the Convention, this article provides that member states with a theoretical possibility to take measures derogating from its obligations under these provisions to the extent required by the exigencies of the situation, including deaths resulting from lawful acts of war. You can read it in the convention, paragraph 2 of Article 15. Let it be reminded that even in the first Chechen case that we yesterday analyzed, the Isaeva case, the court noted that no martial law and no state of emergency has been declared in Chechnya and no derogation has been made under Article 15 of the convention. And, of course, in a certain extent, the court began to apply the international humanitarian law only in recent years. If you come back, for example, to the very famous interstate case, Cyprus versus Turkey, you cannot find there any trace of the international humanitarian law. And perhaps for the first time, the court in its judgment, Corbey versus Hungary, in Hungarian you must pronounce it Corbey versus Hungary, he dealt with international humanitarian law, and then he developed its positions in the Varnava versus Turkey, killings of Cypriot Greek militaries during this military campaign of Turkish forces in 1974 in Cyprus, and disappearance of these persons. For the first time in these two cases, the court dealt with this article 2 linked with the international humanitarian law. I can quote it in this judgment, Varnava versus Turkey, paragraph 185. Article 2 must be interpreted insofar as possible in light of the general principles of international law, including the rules of international humanitarian law, which play an indispensable and universally accepted role in mitigating the savagery and inhumanity of armed conflicts. Said in 2009, yes, for the first time, rather recently. An example of gaining momentum judicial activism on the part of the European Court was application of the international human right, humanitarian right law in the context of Article 7 of the Convention. In this Hungarian case, Corbey versus Hungary, which with the view to find whether the national courts, while convincing the applicant, correctly applied Article 3 of the Geneva Convention of 49. The case was rather sensitive because it dealt with the events of 1956 during the famous Hungarian insurrection against the communist regime, and Corbey participated on the side of the communist regime and is, was supposed as a policeman to kill some fighters. And he was condemned for this by the Hungarian courts, and he complained for the court. He was condemned by the planned retroactive measures of the international humanitarian law, and the conclusion of the national court that in the case the European court stipulated that in order to conclude that in the case it has not been shown that in 1956 it was foreseeable that the applicant's acts constituted a crime against humanity under international law, paragraph 95 of the judgment accordingly. But even in this case, the court did not prefer the international humanitarian law over standards of its own convention. It seems that the court heeded arguments of the applicant, who insisted upon impermissibly of extensive interpretation of the Geneva Convention of 49. And the court wrote down in the paragraph 57 of its judgment on Corbey, the applicant's view, this approach, laudable as it might be in the context of humanitarian law, could not be accepted as being applicable in the field of individual criminal liability, while no extensive interpretation of law was allowed. Thus, the court distinguished clearly between individual criminal liability in the internal law and the individual liability responsibility under international humanitarian law. And in the Corbey case, the court made this conclusion. I can quote last time this judge Corbey. He repudiated positions of national courts comprising the position of the institutional court, constitutional court of Hungary, and drew an unequivocal conclusion, paragraph 95. In the light of all the circumstances, the court concludes that it has not been shown that it was foreseeable that the applicant's acts constituted a crime against humanity under international law. As a result, there has been a violation of the Article 7 of the Convention. You know, the Article 7 of the Convention prohibits to punish somebody if the provisions of law at the moment of the commitment of crime did not provide this kind of punishment. And suddenly we have the reversal of this position of the court, rather prudent, in the Kononov case, Kononov versus Latvia. I can remind you that in the judgment of a chamber of the court, Yes, 24 July 2008, the chamber found by 4-3 the violation of Article 7, because the chamber used widely the approach and developed them in the Corbey case. and in any sense even anticipated the corporate approach. But the Grand Chamber of the Court reversed this judgment, and as you see, the date sent in May 2010 didn't find violation of Article 7 of the Convention, and by 40 votes to 3. And what is the sense of the case, if you permit? The fact amounts to the events of May 1944 in one of the Latvian villages, Malibati. There was the final weeks of fights between Soviet army and German troops, and the villagers, according to the applicant, collaborated with the Germans, delivered persons who stopped in the village as Red Partisans, fighting for the Soviet army, and then it was decided, according to the applicant, by ad hoc military court to punish this population of the village, and he commanded a small group of partisans who came and killed some villagers who collaborated actively with Germans, comprising a pregnant woman. And the applicant did what disturbed until 2000, and then was condemned by the Latvian courts. Very complicated procedures in Latvia. The Latgal Regional Court qualified his actions as a normal criminal act, while the same of the Supreme Court of Latvia qualified it as a war crime. And he was sentenced to 6 years, etc., etc. Well, and he complained as Corbelli before the court, pretending that he was not condemned according to the convention, because there is what there was a prescription for his acts according to the Soviet, then enforced the Soviet Criminal Court of 1928, and that his acts didn't constitute a war crime. And in this case, the European Court applied rather widely the international humanitarian law. At least 60 paragraphs before there was nothing, and suddenly 60 paragraphs in this case. In this case, it is really a leading case on this matter. We can speculate why the court did it in this, specifically in this sensitive case, and why not in other cases, but it's another story. It's not my task to speculate on this. I wrote a very merchant, perhaps, article, follow-up to Kononov in the Russian review Prava Chelovyeka, Practice of the European Court of Human Rights, Practice of the European Court of Human Rights. I can leave it to you if you want the English and the Russian version of this article that I use now in my conference. And what is interesting in this judgment is the fact that the sudden interest for the international humanitarian law was not really manifested in the chamber judgment of Kononov, but it was developed in the Grand Chamber judgment, and the court drew back very far from its own methodology, having substituted in any sense Amnesty International or International Committee of the Red Cross on this sense. Yes. It's my opinion. As a comparison, I can mention that the United Nations International Court of Justice doesn't allow itself to refer to provisions of the international humanitarian law, but it does so very rarely, in any case, it doesn't make its legal positions directly dependent on the international humanitarian law. I can cite, for example, some judgments of the International Court of Justice case concerning the armed activities on the territory of Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo versus Uganda, the judgment of 2005, etc., etc. There are many judgments on this judgment. The International Court of Justice avoided carefully to give a direct appreciation of international humanitarian law. And on the contrary, specialized international criminal tribunals, the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, International Tribunal for Rwanda, more often refer to international humanitarian law due to the specific nature of ratione materia of the cases before them, war crisis, crimes against humanity and genocide, etc. However, the same International Tribunal for Yugoslavia acts in such cases cautiously enough, choosing, for instance, to talk about influence of norms on international human rights law upon the international humanitarian law, drawing clear distinction between the two. I can quote the case Kunaric of the International Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, judgment of 22 February 2001, where the International Tribunal for former Yugoslavia concluded, notions developed in the field of human rights can be transposed in international humanitarian law only if they take into consideration the specificities of the latter body of law. The end of the story. Yes, we see that even this International Tribunal for Human Rights rather rather prudent, rather cautious. Unbiased observers explain such restraint of the international court in application of norms and principles of international humanitarian law by a possibility of a conflict of provisions of almost boundless international humanitarian law and strict prescriptions of the status regime of these courts, first of all, as regards the limits of their jurisdiction. There is an evident conflict between the limited jurisdiction of these international courts and this ocean of norms of international humanitarian law, which is not so abounding. And in the case of Kononov, the European Court, despite its own case law and the case law of other international courts, for the first time has built its finding almost exclusively upon provisions of the international humanitarian law, for its convenience, having named it in its conclusion as international law. Well, for the European Court of Human Rights, for the first time, the international humanitarian law is an international law as such, and must be applied in his judgments. It was said also for the first time, it's paragraph 243, you can find it in the text of Court of Case. Such activism gives birth to a questionable precedent, considering the fact that the court deals with quite sensitive cases connected with armed conflicts, unless, of course, the precedent was set up specially for Kononov case. Yes, because this activism was not followed in some other sensitive cases concerning the applications of the convention, especially Al-Jaida and other cases versus Great Britain, recent cases concerning the acts of British soldiers in Iraq. But you see, in Kononov, the court did it. And the court didn't give a strong definition who was these villagers of Mali Bati who was killed by Red Partisans. You can find this very vague qualification that they were civilians who had participated in hostilities. Civilians who had participated in hostilities. Very strange category that you cannot find in international humanitarian law. And on this respect in my article, I refer to very known Oppenheim and Lauterbach work, who is mentioned Oppenheim International Law, Volume 2, Disputes, War and Neutrality. What is written in this study of Oppenheimer and Lauterbach? Private individuals who take up arms and commit hostilities against the enemy do not enjoy the privileges of armed forces. And the enemy has, according to a customary rule of international law, the right to treat such individuals as war criminals. But they cease to be private individuals if they organize themselves in a manner which, according to the Hague Convention, confers upon them the status of members of regular forces. And you see, as regards war treason by civilian villagers, Professor Oppenheimer here too is quite clear in defining this notion. War treason may constitute information of any kind given to the enemy. Any voluntary assistance to military operations of the enemy, be it by serving as guide in the country, by opening the door of a dependent habitat, etc. And one element this eminent author concludes, what reason gives a right to belligerents to consider them when committed by enemy soldiers or enemy private individuals within their lines as acts of illegitimate warfare and consequently punishable as war crimes? Which kind of punishment provides Oppenheimer and Lauterbach? What will the punishment be? The suggested answer is all war crimes may be punished with death. In any sense, the eminent lawyers, you cannot expect them to be pro-Russians or pro-Soviets, are very firm on these conclusions concerning this exceptional situation of war between two sides and the collaboration of local population with one of the parties. Well, and the court, of course, as I told you, qualified the villagers as civilians who participate in hostilities. There is a good expression in French, comprend qui peut. Comprend qui peut. Well, and understand in the way you understand. What does it mean? Civilians participated in the conflict. Well, and that's because, of course, this judgment on the all this operation to imply the international humanitarian law in its very exclusive and sensitive case led the court to another invention, in spite of the individual responsibility provided by the contemporary humanitarian law. It didn't exist yet in the moment of the conflict in 44, because the Geneva Convention was signed, as you know, in 49. They invent another notion, individual command responsibility. Individual command responsibility. Without giving explanation, what does it mean, international command responsibility? Well, and of course, it's rather useful perhaps to remind that before the Universal Declaration of 1948, the individual was not recognized as a subject on the international law. At the only exception was made during the Nuremberg trial for the German high officials, yes, during the Second World War, but as an exceptional, well, that's for the first time in the history of international law, the European Court made the same exception for the opposite side, somebody who was an officer of the Soviet Army. Well, and the court concluded The fact that a person acted pursuant to order of his government or superior doesn't relieve him from the responsibility under international law, provided a moral choice was in fact possible to him. The question is now to say what moral choice had this young 22 years soldier who was sent by his superiors to this village. Did he have a real moral choice as a general of Stalin or as another high official? No, he didn't have this moral choice. And in fact, I can give some other examples of this interpretation, but I think that's enough. Of course, we must take into account that both the international law in its entirety and the international humanitarian law and the international criminal law contain today, I underline this word, today, a rather exhaustive list of corpora of war crimes, but there was not so decent in 1944. This is the question. And that's because even in Korbeli case, the court concluded that at that time, the notion is of the war crime was not so wide as was applied by the Constitutional Court of Hungary, for example, etc. And of course, there are some norms in contemporary military law, for example, in Germany, which is more reticent concerning this notion of war crime. Well, in any case, what is done is done. And in this judgment, what is crucial that the court stipulated that even applying retroactively the international humanitarian law, which did not exist at the time of crime, the national tribunals didn't violate the norms of the Article 7 of the Convention, and any prescription provisions in domestic law is not applicable. It's paragraph 233 of the judgment of the Grand Chamber. Of course, there were some dissents, and the president of the European Court of Human Rights, Jean-Paul Costa, who was dissent in this case, he underlined his dissent and opinion. A distinction must be made between international law as enforced at the material time and as it subsequently emerged and gradually became established. I think this is a rather wise position. I was in the composition, I would also vote as and react as the president of the court reacted. But the majority, pushed by a kind of activism, at last they had this to deal with international humanitarian law, they came, to my opinion, too far and created a huge number of comments in the legal press. Some of these writers followed the court. Many of them didn't understand the reason of the court. I have with me some publications, for instance, in French, and one of the most known interpreters of the European Convention, Emmanuel Dicot, writes, "Oh, the only merit of the Grand Chamber judgment is at least to take seriously international humanitarian law." But he concludes, He concludes. Mais fallait-il pour autant parler de rétroactivité? Now then, did it was so necessary to deal with retroactive application of this law? This is his conclusion. And another conclusion of other law journal, L'Europe de Liberté, September 2010, speaking of the curious application of rules of use in bail law, and also is dealing with the flagrant contradiction. You see, but of course the reaction was not unanimous, nevertheless, it is one of the examples when the court didn't have a real experience on applying the international humanitarian law, his conclusions were made in a confused way. And let me take in consideration another case, Janowitz and others. Do you have some questions on this case? Or we can continue?
No? I have just a question on the article about the chronograph.
Yeah?
Is it available in the internet or only in the international?
My dear, it's available especially for you, but I draw it on this and you can give it a copy. Yeah, come here. And in the other case, Janowitz versus Russia, the court also dealt with the international humanitarian law, but more prudently and more restrictively. And what is important in this case, I can remind you what is this case. This case concerns the tragic facts of the beginning of the Second World War, when Germany occupied the western part of Poland and the Soviet army occupied the eastern part of Poland, and many Polish officers rendered arms to the Soviet army, and many of them, more precisely about 15,000, were led to Russia and incarcerated in concentration camp for them in different regions of Ukraine, Belarus, and Central Russia. And in March 1940, the famous Minister of Interior, Beria, asked to Stalin the permission to judge them because they are enemies of the Soviet regime, and to condemn them to a capital sentence. What it was done, and more than 14,700 Polish militaries and policemen were killed in several days in different places, but it is known as Katyn tragedy because one of these main camps was in Katyn, near Smolensk, by the way. In Katyn, I visited it. It's the only place where you never can listen to birds singing in a forest. Never. It's a death silence. It's so impressive because before there were dozens of Soviets who was killed by the NKVD in 37-38 as enemies of the people. Then Polish soldiers and officers. And the story is that in when this region was occupied by Germans, they discovered collective groves and invited the delegation of International Red Cross to discover the rest, the cadavers of these persons. And but during the Nuremberg trial, the representatives of the Soviet Union tried to reverse their responsibility to Germans, saying that it was Germans who killed these poor people. And that's only with the perestroika, when Gorbachev discovered it in his famous secret file on Katyn, who discovered it and he rendered it public, he gave it to the Polish president, and then President Yeltsin ordered also to begin the investigation on this issue. It was a political and moral choice, but first of all. The investigation was led jointly by Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, and Poles. And in the final meeting in 1995, they concluded that the most important thing was done, that it was not really possible to find something new in the file, and they asked the Russian colleagues to continue this investigation, and some countries gave documents they were in possession of this moment. And in 2004, the Russian prosecutor general decided to stop the investigation because no new elements were found. The story is that in 1957, the Politburo of the Russian Communist Party decided, under the demand of Shaletin and Khrushchev, to destroy 80% of the files. 80%. Why? Because in many of these files you could find the very known names of Molotov, of Kalinin, Stalin, etc., who signed this permission to kill these militaries. And the story says that when Khrushchev came to power, the first thing that he did, he asked 200 agents of the KGB to destroy all the documents where there was his signature, comprising also the Katyn file. Of course, it was many of these volumes, two-thirds of these volumes were given to the Polish side, but some of these volumes were not given and was declared as top-secret documents because they comprised, perhaps, I don't know, I never saw this document, some infiltrated agents and some cases concerning agents who was not punished and who was pardoned, etc., and perhaps also the names of the executors. We don't know what these documents contain. But in any case, the relatives of the killed persons were not satisfied, of course, of this result, and they asked this document, and the document was never showed to them, except the Russian lawyers who read this document, and under the special document undertaken to not disclose the secret they knew. It's a procedure, criminal procedure in the Russian Federation. Then, and of course, these relatives seized the European Court of Human Rights with their complaints concerning non-respect of the material and procedural obligations of the Article 2 of the Convention, first of all, right to life. Yes, even the Convention was adopted after these events, and the Russia joined the Convention on the 6th of May of 1908. And what is interesting in this case, the fact that the court, the chamber, dealt seriously with the temporary jurisdiction of the court. What was not made, unfortunately, in the Konev judgment. And its reasoning, the chamber, who also was divided, that's because the judgment is not yet final, the court stipulated, in regard to the principle of legal certainty, the court's temporal jurisdiction as regards compliance with the procedural obligation of Article 2 in respect of deaths that occur before the critical date is not open-ended. However, the court wouldn't exclude that in certain circumstances the connection could also be based on the need to ensure that the guarantees and the underlying values of the Convention are protected in a real and effective manner. But what is important for the court, this so-called critical date. As the major part of the investigation terminated before the date of the ratification of by Russia of the convention, the 1st of May 1998, and the major part of the investigation terminated in 1995, the majority of the court concluded that the court cannot have a temporary jurisdiction to deal with this matter. To deal with the matter, with the reference of this famous Schiedich case and some other Jularich case, etc., Yefimenko versus Ukraine, in which the court also concluded that he cannot have to the this rational temporary issue. But the court nuanced his position. I can cite the end of the paragraph 139. Should new material come to light in the post-ratification period, and should it be sufficiently weighty and compelling to warrant a new round of proceedings, the court will have temporal jurisdiction to satisfy itself that the respondent state has discharged its procedural obligation under Article 2 in a manner compatible with the principles enunciated in its case law. Well, the court didn't close the door. He said, yes, if Russians or Belarusians or Ukrainians or Poles could find some new material, it will be another story. But there was no new materials in the file. That's because with a common consent, the investigation was stopped. And what is also interesting is the qualification of this act. Of course, it was the act of war crime, without any doubt. But the court preferred to have a little bit more nuanced position. The court accepts that the mass murder of Polish prisoners by the Soviet secret police had the features of the war crime. You understand this small difference? Has the features of a war crime. And of course, he is referred to both to the Hague Convention and Geneva Conventions, etc., but also he is rather prudent in this case. And finally, the court concludes, a distinction must be drawn between a domestic decision to investigate, which could be made on account of political, legal, or ethical considerations at national level, and the procedural obligations to investigate, which flows from the convention and engages the international responsibility of the state. It is only the latter, but not the former, that is subject of the court's scrutiny, and in the instant case, no such procedural obligation can be said to have arisen. In other words, this phrase, conclusion of the court, means that if Russia ratified convention, let's say in 1984 or 83, before the conclusion of the main part of the investigation, thus she could occur a certain responsibility. But formally speaking, Russia was not obliged before the 5th May 98 to engage any steps concerning the investigation, no matter rational temporis. See, that's because even voting for non-violation, me and my Ukrainian colleague Anna Gutkivska, we wrote a separate opinion on the land. It's rather strange conclusion of the court. Either you say clearly that no jurisdiction at all because it's rational temporis. Either you say yes, in certain circumstances it can be like this. I remind the famous judgment Scharfenkopf versus Austria concerning the prohibition of in Austria to conclude homosexual marriages. And the chamber was unanimous that there was no violation of Article 12 of the convention. Because the convention don't provide the marriage between the persons of the same sex, because the founding fathers didn't imagine the situation in 1950, but the court sent a message. But perhaps in the future, this article could be interpreted differently. How in an international law can be interpreted, in international agreement can be interpreted differently without the consent of all the signatures of this convention? That's the Vienna Convention on International Treaties. He provides the common consent, the consensus. You see, but this kind of activism is very dangerous, very dangerous. That's because I don't want to be appreciated as a vulgar conservatist. But I think that a good portion of reasonable is necessary in this kind of very sensitive cases. And of course, the court also views in the Janowitz some notions of the international humanitarian law, but only by citing them in four paragraphs. You compare 60 paragraphs in Kornov, a small four paragraphs in Janowitz's case, only mentioned the Hague Convention 97, Geneva 49, Nuremberg, and the Convention of the Non-Prescription of Military Crimes of 68. And that's all. That's all. And of course, some colleagues, it's what's more interesting, that who voted against the violation of Article 2, the small majority of judges from Russia, Ukraine, Slovenia, and Czech Republic. Judges who voted for the violation of Article 2 procedural issue, judges from Germany, Luxembourg, and Liechtenstein. What do you see? This little bit of conflict east-west that appears in this judgment. Yes?
Ask you for a comment, because when we were talking about the interpretation by the tribunal of the convention that was actually ratified inside half a century ago, and well, I can see some connection with the idea of like the European Union Treaty, which has its own Court of Justice, mm-hmm. and Human Rights Convention has also its own Court of Human Rights, and actually, we talk about that during all the week, that it's actually interpreted like the case law is showing like in the terms of judgments mm-hmm. that are rendered. So actually, can we say maybe that states, by a signature of this convention, they somehow accepted the role of this future tribunals and courts, to interpret the convention and to give a new signification, because the same critics are addressed to the Court of Justice of Europe.
Yes, yes, yes.
That it's totally inventing new rights.
Yes, but you know, I told you in the beginning of my conference that in 1977 the Court of the Tyre versus the United Kingdom stipulated that the convention is a legal instrument who can be interpreted differently with the change in situation, etc. Yes, yes, but I think it's a wise position, but this position of the court must be abused by a liberal part of judges, ultra-liberals, who are, exercising a kind of judicial activism. It's now well discussed in our court. Does it mean, judicial activism? Yes, do we have a right to this judicial activism or not? Or we are bound, not by the convention, by the discipline of case law, and only in exceptional situation we can do something different. But you see, what is justifying this kind of activism, who wanted that the court found a violation of procedural obligation of the Russian Federation on this Genovese case, is the position of the minority in the common dissenting opinion In view of the long period of uncertainty and frustration suffered by the applicants, and the not merely contradictory but indeed incomprehensive approach of the Russian authorities, this case has to be considered as truly exceptional. You know, an exceptional case justifies an exceptional approach. It's the logic of minority, you know. And what's the main reason of this exception character? Long period of uncertainty and frustration suffered by the applicants. Of course it's a moral criteria. I agree with you, but it's not a legal criteria, you know. That's because we are between two fires very often in this sense of cases. How do we want to reason? To reason as moralists and as, for example, Mahatma Gandhi, or as a judge? It's a dilemma. It's a cruel dilemma very often. It's a personal choice, yes? And especially in this Konnath case when you have the pregnant woman killed and then brought to the fire. In this Yanovitz case, of course. As we say often between us, a judge must keep his heart in hot but his head in cold. See, but otherwise the call will be transformed in an Amnesty International. I like very much Amnesty International, but it's another matter, it's another institution with other criteria. It's not a court created by states. See, and we must have some links. Because applying international humanitarian law, the court must be very prudent, because it's a very, very important arm, but also a rather dangerous arm if you is tempted to deviate of your core document, your mother, your Bible, the convention. Yes, the convention is our Bible, and the rest is something secondary. Yes, of course, international law, international law. That's because I wanted to show you. But for example, in Varnava case, we had also this temptation to apply what we applied didn't apply in Yanovitz case. But the problem is that the events in Cyprus, the main part of the same was in 1974, but Turkey recognized the right for individual petition 1 year after. The period between two events was too short to say that this eruption is temporary. But formally speaking, inadmissible this case, eruption is temporary, formally speaking. As also this one. Yes, but you see, that's because in Shilev, we'll deal with the case of a death of a patient in the hospital in Slovenia who occurred before the ratification by Slovenia of the European Convention. The death. We didn't find a violation or a substantial violation because the state was not responsible, because it was an instantaneous act. But the state began the investigation before ratification and continued this investigation after ratification. That's because we had this so-called continuing situation that proves that we could deal with this civil case, etc., etc. That's because this notion of continuing situation is very important in the applying of international humanitarian law if the court wants to be objective. You see that it's really a story to follow, because, of course, Yanovitz judgment is not final, and the applicants and the Polish government asked the court to reconsider the case, and we received the reply in autumn if the court accepts or not this demand and will reconsider or not this case. I don't know. I can't guarantee. Well, that's all that I wanted to say. Perhaps you have some questions. I'll be ready to reply to them if you want.
Maybe if you don't mind, Anatoly, then yes. I give a few thoughts on this. On some of those cases, I think we have to keep in mind that the Council of Europe was initially created as a sort of anti-communist organization. And therefore...
Let's say democratic organization.
Yeah, okay, but from the point of view of this interpretation, these were almost like connected things. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, and in the 90s, one by one, East European countries were also adopted in this new system, then actually to somehow condemn some of the communist practices or practices conducted by communist regimes actually did fit into the picture of, let's say, liberal triumph, the ideas, the liberal reading of you know, democracy and rights. And so this as a background. The other is that, for example, specifically in Koronov, of course, the difficulty is that when we're talking about international humanitarian law and international criminal law in the context of World War II, then to some extent, I mean, all those who have, we have a little bit studied the history, we realize that at Nuremberg, for example, part of the law was in a way also created ad hoc. It was said that this is the law, but they couldn't rely on treaties. And one can be pretty sure that especially the Soviet side under Stalin, you know, they very clearly thought about this law, that this is the law for the fascists. So I am pretty sure that Stalin didn't think of this standard as a universal standard. And here is this problem of whether international, let's say, use ad bellum and use in bello, whether they are or whether they are not connected. Because international humanitarian law, for instance, its main idea is based on the presumption that it doesn't matter who started it, there are certain rules that are applicable, you know, whether you are an aggressor or a victim of aggression, whereas my sense and sort of recollection of stories of World War II in the Soviet version was very strongly that, you know, the good ones don't commit war crimes. They have to defend themselves, and I think this... So there has been this element there as well. And what concerns judicial activism, then of course these cases wouldn't end up on the desk of Strasbourg judges if there wouldn't be, let's say, judicial activism and prosecutorial activism in some of the East European countries. Let's say if Latvia wouldn't have been nasty enough to start Kononov, it would never have ended up in Strasbourg. And I'm pretty sure that some of the, if you read the opinions, the judgments in the section, then I think particularly revealing is the Dutch judge's opinion, where he sort of very openly speaks about his sort of ambivalent attitude towards World War II and says that he grew up with the notion that whoever collaborated Nazis was doing a bad thing, and the opposite was also true. And one can almost see that he really actually doesn't want to have this case at his table, but he has to decide. He's a judge in this section, and he has to take some position. And in this sense, those cases somehow also they bring East European history with its complexity and these. Yes. Sometimes double, sometimes triple occupations, or even nasty things committed by national regimes. They somehow, these cases bring them more to the European historical mainstream. Even West European judges have to think about what were those messy situations that people were in at those times.
Yes, of course, but even in the first column of judgment, the chamber judgment, of course there was a rather interesting dissenting opinions, not only the judge, the Dutch judge, who was in the past the prosecutor general of Netherlands, but also the opinion of the Icelandic judge, who wrote a really political comment to this judgment. Yes, you see, it showed that... judges can be animated by different reasonings, yes. And by the way, you evoke this story of the communist regimes. You know this article of Milosevic, how do you call it? Is this from Lithuania?
Milosevic.
Excuse me for the pronunciation. It's the history of the communist regime in the European Court of Human Rights cases. It was published in the Baltic Yearbook of International Law.
The editor-in-chief of which is Anatoly's colleague, Ineta Ziemela from Latvia.
My close friend, by the way, yeah. Book of International Law. What is the date? It's, I have a bad copy, 2009. Yes, 2009. Yes, it has you on that place. 2009, yes or no?
It's volume 9, 2009.
Volume 9, wow. You can find this article if you are interested in this issue. Of course, I do not agree with all the conclusions, but there is a interesting information about all these cases, and you will see the some other cases. What, for example, we have 2-3 minutes. For example, I asked to my colleagues from Baltic states, please, in the cases concerning these states, when we are describing these events of the annexion by the Soviet Union of Baltic states, please use one interpretation. Because in one judgment, you see occupation, in another annexion, in other into incorporation. Yeah? Both terms are, the three terms are different significations in the international law. Occupation is a military occupation. Annexion is an action in other thing. Incorporation is another thing. But the European Court used three notions without any distinction. Is it good for the judge? I don't think so. I don't think so. Because you see that even in this very sensitive cases, very often the approaches are historically, politically colored. But it's inevitable. It's inevitable. I recognize it. But nevertheless, I think that more discipline would be useful for the court.
Well, I think the reason for that is that the Baltic states and Russia on political level, they disagree on, you know, how to call it and
yes,
what happens.
Yes, yes.
And this, every time this debate comes somehow again, and it's also a wonderful example of,
yes, yes.
Let's say Anatoly said that the declaration of the Icelandic judge was rather political to him. Well, certain notions, in a way, are both legal and political, and probably the occupation in the context of Baltic history is one of such notions where it's both legal and political. So my call for the future would be that perhaps the Balts and Russians should try to sit down at some point and kind of find a common ground and settle it between themselves and not kind of bother the other Europeans every time and again and again with that. So maybe that's something we could do in the future. I think there is actually among liberal elites, I sense in Moscow, I don't see a resistance to the idea that Stalin sort of used threat of force to take these places over, but I think there is more kind of disagreement about what then would be the consequences for 50 years of this, let's say, forcible element initially in 1940.
Yes, I can give an example. You know, in this concerning the Katyn tragedy, the State Duma issued unanimously a resolution in where it was called as a crime against humanity, as a crime of totalitarian regime, etc. It is mentioned in this document of Yanovich's judgment, because, of course, but I think some terminological discipline is necessary. Is necessary in this. To avoid all kinds of speculations. It was in the Konev case and a little in the Yanovich case, but it's inevitable. It's inevitable. seconds.
Yeah, but why wouldn't you agree that it was both? Because if you look at the chronology of events, then first you have occupation and then you have annexation. Now the question is, if we say that there were treaties in force that, for example, prohibited the annexation somehow in international law, if one agrees with this presumption, then an illegal annexation would also in a way remain an occupation.
But it's another story. Of course it's another story. Of course, but let's discuss it.
Yeah, and let's try to create the
not
but I also have to say that you know, Anatoly is a very liberal judge in some ways.
Really? I don't think so.
No, I said in some ways. I know that, you know, the liberal is a cursing word in Russia, right? So sometimes, in some context. But I think if you read the declarations of Mies, the foreign ministry in Moscow, then I think they somehow the disagreement is more fundamental. They kind of say that, well,
yeah,
it didn't happen in that way. So the you know, with Anatoly we can discuss, you know, how to call it, right? And we can have an enlightened discussion on that. But when I listen to the let's say political legal discourse between our governments, then I see really more reluctance on Moscow's side to talk about it. And it's of course connected, I believe, with the question, what are the consequences of all this story for today? Because in a way you have to also keep in mind that the fact that the Russian-speaking population in Estonia and Latvia didn't get automatic citizenship rights here is directly linked to the occupation argument. I mean, that is basically the argument through which the Baltic nations, let's say, sold also in the West the idea that why this is okay or why this is acceptable. And I believe that we discussed these notions of law and or let's say a legal text and then justice in how they are sometimes conflictuous in the Russian interpretation. And I my sense is that a lot of this Russian criticism also about the occupation theory comes from the fact that in the end it actually the sort of very hardcore interpretation of it puts the Russian population here in a sort of forever second tier significance,
and
and no one in the right mind politically would want that. So that is also natural, and
yes.
So perhaps we can hope that time will heal some of these wounds, and actually the Balts and the Russians can agree how to call these things. And so anyway, any other comments or questions on that, or we can. Then I suggest that we give a warm applause to Judge Hovland.
See you again perhaps. Another issue, yes. Well, and a good return to your countries, yes.
Thank you.
Well, see you later.